nice. That's Minnesota's own Becky Buller, and I Serve a God. Becky from down the Mankato-way, southern Minnesota, and just become a fixture in the bluegrass world here in recent years. Very talented young lady. Wayne Watson before that with Watercolor Ponies. It's 10 minutes after the hour. It's a Winsome Wednesday. And Doug Greenwald joins us from Columbia, Maryland. Doug, the senior teaching fellow and executive director of Preserving Bible Times. And for those of you who may be new to the station, maybe you're new to Doug as well. Doug and his ministry have been around for, what, 15 years now. And the specialty of Preserving Bible Times is bringing us the historic and cultural context of Scripture. And Doug's been with us now for, well, over 5 years with a conversation with us just about every Wednesday. They're all on podcasts. So we've got a glorious history of conversations with Doug. And if anybody goes through there and listens to those, and there's a whole lot of them, but I mean, just take three or four and click on them, listen to them, you will have something that I've come to call an aha moment. And I've had a bunch of them. And David, you have too. Wouldn't you vouch for that?
From about the second time that Doug was on with us, I've been having aha moments just about every week.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I mean, it's like turning a light bulb on in a darkened room, or the room is the volume is, or the rheostat for the light bulb is turned way down.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, somebody turns the real lights on, and I said, "Wow, whole picture."
It does bring the whole picture into focus. It's like the Bible jumping out in three dimensions in living color all of a sudden. It's a wonderful thing. But Doug, you have your own aha moments, and then you're kind enough to pass them on to us. Any good ones lately?
Well, actually, yes. And if I think about aha moments, there's probably at least two categories. One is the I didn't know that moment. That's a lesser quality, lower level. And then there's the aha moment that either changes a paradigm or illuminates a paradigm, and that's a world-class aha moment for me. As you know, I've got two jobs. My day job is about biblical context, and we've talked about aspects of that for years. But my night job continues to grow, and that is to bring discipling insights to God's kingdom. They have their origin in contextual understanding of the scriptures, but more and more they're getting into analytical and analysis and frameworks and other aspects of that. And 10 days or so ago, I was teaching Making Disciples Jesus' Way for a weekend out in Phoenix, Arizona. And I've taught this material 50-100 times, and I'm always trying to make it better. And usually something is said or something happens in every one of these conferences that allows me to tweak the next one and make it just a little bit better. But toward the end of this one, sort of with 15 minutes left before it was over, I generally open it up to the floor, which I do a number of times, but this is the last one, and I say, "Give me your reactions. Pass along, if you would, some of the things that were new to you or struck you or were the aha moment for you or the lights went on." And one I usually get, and I got it again, was people saying, "You know, this making disciples thing is actually doable." And I've heard that before, but then a lady came along with a slight variation of that observation, which just made my day, and it's still making my day. And I think it has enormous implications for the church. And yet it's just a simple little observation she made. And that's one of my better aha moments here lately. She said this, "You know, this discipling stuff is for the daily flow of life. It fits in the flow and rhythm of daily life." And you know, when she said that, I said, "Thank you for passing that along." And I thought that was a nice comment. And then about several hours later, it hit me like a ton of bricks. What was she saying on the other side of that statement? Her perception was that making disciples and discipling is not something for the daily flow of life. It's something extra. It's a class we take over at the church, or it's a curriculum that we go to. But it doesn't fit and flow in the rhythm of daily life. It's outside of it. And I thought, wow, that's what the church has not been communicating. Mm-hmm. Mostly silently, of course. But what a perception that needs to be recognized, that needs to be addressed and changed. And if you take what the prior comment was, that one I repeatedly hear, you know, this is actually doable. What's on the other side of that one?
What's
perception?
Yeah.
That making disciples and discipling for them isn't doable. Mm-hmm. It may be doable for others, but not for me. Mm-hmm. So, you know, those were crashing paradigm, seismic aha moments for me. I'm still processing them and trying to figure out how can we help the church communicate that this kind of discipling stuff is for daily life. It fits in the flow and rhythm of daily life. It's not something outside of it. It's not something special. It's not a separate program. It's not a distinctive curriculum, you know, outside of the flow.
It's not an additional chore laid on us by the church.
Exactly, yeah. Or an obligation, or whatever.
And not so, even an obligation, and you've made this clear to us in the past. The first step is understanding what a disciple is. The second step is deciding what a disciple does and how a disciple behaves. N.T. Wright makes this case. I was just dazzled over at internetmonk.com this morning. He's talking about the mission of a Christian, how the whole Christian faith has been misstated. It's not... for the purpose of getting you to heaven and avoiding hell. It's for the purpose of making you the hands and feet of Jesus in this world to the world, reflecting God's image to them. And that's very much a part of day-to-day life, minute by minute. It's not an additional layer, an obligation, a job you have to do so that you can kind of say, oh, well, finish that one for the day. I'm on my way now on to other things. It's life itself.
It's like it's a lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
Or something you do just on Sunday.
Exactly. And you know, that's a great observation, David, because we have approached it without even realizing it in a compartmentalization way. There are certain things we do on Sunday, and then there are certain things we do in the rest of the week, and they're not the same. And that leads to this notion that discipling is outside my daily life world. It only belongs for Sunday in the church setting. And then anyway, I'm still processing this one, and I think this one's going to go in lots of directions, but I still got to get my arms around it. And to pick up another one, and you just segued it for me, during one of the breaks of this Making Disciples Jesus Way conference out in Phoenix, I had just finished developing what I call the Abide Sphere. It's part of the framework that we've developed here at Preserving Bible Times for helping people get a vision for and understand and see what are some of the ingredients of making disciples. I had just said that in the Abide Sphere, spending time with the Lord, which is where all this starts, the energy source, the spark plugs of the V8 engine that drives the Abide Sphere, if you will, are the spiritual disciplines. Meditation, contemplation, prayer, Bible study. And at the break, a very wise person came up to me who said, Doug, you need to add service in your list of spiritual disciplines in the Abide Sphere. And this chap's name was Bob. And I said, Bob, you're right. Service is a spiritual discipline, but I've got it over in the body life sphere and engage the world sphere. There are three spheres in this framework. He said, no. It belongs in the abide sphere as well. And I said, okay, flesh that thought out for me. And he said, well, in my neighborhood, there is a recluse who lives about four houses down the street. We never see him, and he refuses to maintain his yard, you know, cut his grass and all that sort of stuff, pull the weeds. Said, so the Lord nudged me some years ago to cut this guy's grass for him, an act of service. And I began to cut his grass every week. And each time I was cutting his grass, I was spending time with the Lord. So as I was serving him, I was spending time with the Lord. Well, after 2.5 years, this guy finally came out on the front porch and offered me a glass of lemonade. I knew he'd been watching me through the curtains for 2.5 years, but he never stuck his head out the door. Finally, after 2.5 years, he did. And so we were able to strike up a relationship. And he said, 3 years later, this is now at the 5.5 year point of cutting his grass, he actually invited me in for a dinner. And to cut what obviously is a long story here, after 13 years, this guy accepted the Lord. And he says, so as I was serving this guy by cutting his grass, I was actually spending time with the Lord. So service is part of abiding. And, you know, that was another big, big paradigm shift that now is in the newest version, which I'm going to be teaching this weekend up in Philadelphia. Yet another continuous improvement on how to help people understand how discipling and making disciples fits in the ordinary flow and rhythm of daily life.
Yeah, and that's, I was just going to use that to emphasize your point. This is what the lady was talking about. That was just in the natural course of his day. Go cut the lawn of your neighbor. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
And then, if you got time for one more here. As you may recall, last August, I was down in Orlando with several people, and we were all brought together to process two questions. What does a discipling, making disciple of Jesus look like? And second question, what are the barriers and attitude changes? What are the barriers that need to be removed and the attitudes that need to be changed in churches for them to truly become vibrant, vital, energetic, discipling environments? And a lot of good stuff is still in my folder from that conference, and I've been processing, how does this all come together? I mean, how can I start to tie some of these threads together and then share that in a written form in my bi-weekly reflections? And I could never find the crystal, if you will, and freeze that thought, because now I'm going to go into another analogy here. I remember well my junior year in high school when I was taking chemistry, where one day the teacher wanted us to understand supersaturated solutions. And so we went back to our benches and we lit our Bunsen burners and we put a beaker on a stand. We had some water in that beaker. And before we actually started to heat the beaker up, we poured some sugar into it. And after a while, no more sugar would go in the solution because the room temperature water was saturated. But he said, no, keep pouring more sugar in. So we had a pile of sugar in the bottom of this beaker. And then you start to heat it up with the Bunsen burner. And the hotter the water gets, the more its capacity to absorb sugar increases, until we actually had this water at a boiling level, and indeed all of the sugar went into solution. Then we turned the Bunsen burner off and let that beaker just sit there for several hours, untouched, unmolested, undisturbed. And as it cools down, it maintains a transparent look. You know, you can look right through it. And after several hours, when it had gotten back down to room temperature, the teacher had us take a grain of sand and hold it over the top of the surface of this beaker now and drop the grain of sand. And as soon as that grain of sand hit the surface, the whole beaker became a salt crystal, or a sugar crystal. A supersaturated solution, when perturbated, technical word, something intervenes in it, will suddenly cause the whole thing to become an enormous crystal. Well, I've been waiting for the grain of sand to drop into this supersaturated solution of all these discipling issues that I was exposed to and have known about and I'm processing in my mind. And finally, I believe, the salt crystal, the sugar crystal, suddenly appeared, and it was the word ecosystem. And so what I'm, the last couple of days, what I've been writing on here is going to be under the umbrella of creating a church ecosystem of discipling. What are the ingredients that fit together in a harmonized, balanced, healthy way that allow an ecosystem to be what it was intended to be. So this notion of the ecosystem of discipling for the church is where I'm excited at for the last day and a half. And as soon as this broadcast ends, I'm going to go back to drafting issues and aspects of that. And I really like this notion of an ecosystem because it's delicately balanced. And if some part of an ecosystem gets thrown out of kilter, it upsets everything. Mm-hmm. It changes everything. You know, if you have a swamp that's really a vital, a lively ecosystem for fish and frogs and turtles and all that sort of thing, algae is a good thing, but too much algae is a bad thing. And oxygen is a really good thing in the water, but if the water starts to become oxygen deprived, it's a bad thing. It upsets every aspect of the ecosystem. So I'm starting to think through what are the issues that comprise a discipling ecosystem in churches that are making disciples fruitfully and effectively and successfully so that we can use that as a diagnostic tool for the many churches that aren't.
The word balance comes to my mind, and we've touched on this many, many times over the last 4 years, and that is the difference between evangelizing and discipling. How we've divided them in the Western church. They're two different things. We go to the church on Sunday or Wednesday nights or whenever we go and say, well, make me a disciple. Teach me. And what we're really supposed to be doing is discipling others. And it is that process. It's part and parcel of the fabric of life, like the man who was mowing the lawn. He eventually built a relationship with this recluse neighbor that led to good things. And it's that relationship building which is the essence of discipling, is it not?
Well, it is. And I was just doing some editing work on a manuscript from another person. The tentative title of that manuscript is When Evangelism Leads to Sin. Now, isn't that an engaging title?
Yeah.
And what he meant by that is if all you focus on is evangelism, you're being disobedient. Because the Great Commission is to make disciples, not converts. And it starts with conversion. It doesn't end with conversion. And, you know, even Solomon wouldn't cut the baby in half, but we've taken that seamless Hebrew first century notion of make disciples, and we've cut that baby in half, and we've called one half of it evangelism, and we've cut the other half discipleship. Both words, by the way, do not exist in Scripture. Can't find them in Strong's exhaustive concordance. And then, living the frenetic lives that we do, we have precious little time at the margins of our lives. So with what little time we have left, we say, well, let's at least just save them. But this 30 years of investing and growing in a non-linear, messy process of making disciples, man, we don't have time for that. But let's at least just save them. And that thesis is what that author was saying is sin. That's when evangelism can lead to sin.
And you know, that this idea of process is implicit in your interpretation of the Great Commission, too. And you've explained this to us. And this is one of the first aha moments I've had, because the Great Commission has been a problem for me. I keep looking at that and I say, what was Jesus, one, was he talking to me or was he talking to his disciples? This is just before his ascension. He's commissioning them to do what he's been training them to do for 3.5 years and then some since the 40 days since the resurrection. He's now turning them loose on the world. And as you have explained, it's not going out to make converts. He's saying that in essence, as you go along day by day, you will be making disciples as a matter of course.
Replicate yourself in the natural flow and rhythm of life.
Yes, yes, yes. The natural flow and rhythm of life.
Exactly. That's the huge paradigm shift that's out there. So, I mean, there are layers to this one. One is the preoccupation with evangelism and the absolute slighting of discipling. Then, you know, when you recognize that, hey, we're out of balance here, we got to really start paying attention to discipling, it tends to be a cognitive approach. let's teach, you know, 12 courses in adult education or something like that. And while there certainly is a cognitive component of that, I mean, you do have to know and understand who God is. There's a huge experiential component in being a disciple of Jesus. That's why Luke summarized Jesus' teaching pedagogy in Acts 1:1 as do and teach. He had these guys doing lots of things, changing their paradigms, immersing them in shock therapy experiences before he began to teach them what it all meant and how it all added up. So, you know, even when we realize that we have to start getting serious about making disciples, we can often have too limited, too modest an understanding of that, and we focus it on acquiring knowledge as opposed to acquiring knowledge, yes, but also gaining experiences and integrating what we know with what we do. And that's where the real challenge exists, and that's what we call a process. It's not a cognitive process. It's an integration of a cognitive and an experiential learning process, which is what Jesus actually did with the 12. And if you really want to have another paradigm-changing aha moment, and this came about 18 months ago for me, mm-hmm. when somebody said, Jesus discipled those guys into conversion. So you don't even have to use the word evangelism. You don't even have to think that way. And this is really catching on in the third world mission movement. We're going to disciple people into conversion. The best evangelism strategy is simply to disciple, start to disciple non-believers. Now, is that a big thought?
Wow.
And that is reflecting Christ in the world.
And it's reflecting what Jesus did in the Gospels. Those guys weren't converted the moment he said, follow me. They had no idea what they were getting into. They didn't know who he was, other than a rabbi who spoke with an authority like no other and who could do some, I call them low-level miracles, exorcisms and healings. But that's not uncommon. There's a history of Pharisaic rabbis in the Jewish tradition who have done that, and they preceded Jesus. They're called the Hasidim. Miracle-working Pharisees. So, you know, this notion that they came to Jesus, to use our Western evangelical vernacular, the moment Jesus said, follow me, not true. But after 3 years of getting them to become his disciples and then having the Holy Spirit show up at Pentecost, then they were converted.
You know, I would just David and I were just talking about that yesterday, and in fact, it was prompted by my question, and maybe I can ask you this too. It's kind of an academic thing, but you know, Jesus was born in Bethlehem, and he was raised in Nazareth, and he had his 3.5 years of ministry, and very little do we know of his experiences of his youth, what travels, what teaching he received, what his life was like, but he was crucified, and he was resurrected 3 days later. What was the change, if any, in Jesus between pre- and post-resurrection? Because there was something different about him, physically or spiritually, I can't tell. I mean, Jesus has always been Jesus, but what was it about the resurrection? Was there anything about the resurrection that made a difference in him? Because when he got back to his disciples over that next 40 days, he changed them around entirely. They made a great leap forward. And at the Pentecost, I mean, they were different people. Peter in particular, no longer kind of an awkward, lowly spoken fisherman. He was now leader. There was something that Jesus imparted to them in that time that made a huge difference to them. Was it all Pentecost, or was it part of that his revealing of the scriptures, the inner meaning of all this to them?
Well, as the third member of the Godhead, which is changeless and timeless, nothing changed about his nature through that, but he did emerge, I would suggest, in a triumphant posture, having defeated his enemy and defeated death. So there was that difference. He certainly had a spiritual body, not an earthly body. That was certainly different about him. And something happened, since you brought up Simon Peter here. On the shores of the Sea of Galilee in the 40 days, in the interval after his resurrection, when he recommissioned Peter. So I think that's terribly important. Peter had blown it.
Mm-hmm.
And he had blown it three times in the 24 hours before Jesus was crucified. And so Jesus gave him a threefold reconciliation. He actually prepared a meal for him, of fish that morning. And there is something in the Hebrew tradition called the meal covenant. And there's a symmetry to what Jesus did with Simon Peter. The three times he blown it, so Jesus three times said to him, "Do you love me?" And Jesus gave him a threefold commission: feed my sheep, tend to my sheep, care for my sheep. And someone once pointed out to me 35 years ago, talk about another aha moment, Jesus never said, "Count my sheep," to Peter. Feed them, tend them, care for them. Okay? But don't count them. The counting's up to me. It's my harvest. It's my kingdom. And so that was incredibly helpful for Simon Peter on the shores of the Sea of Galilee that particular morning, because two things happened. He was reconciled with Jesus, and he was publicly acknowledged again in the presence of the band that he was the successor rabbi to Jesus. You remember way back to Caesarea Philippi, when Jesus and Peter have this interchange, and Jesus says, "On this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not prevail against it." The big gap in the mountain, foot of the mountain there, the hole, was considered the gates to Hades by the Romans. And so that's the image that Jesus is drawing upon when he says the gates of Hades will not prevail against it. And then a couple of verses later, he says to Peter, and I will give you the gates, the keys to the kingdom. And whatever you bind will be bound on earth, and whatever you loose will be loosed. Binding and loosing is the authority of a rabbi. And that's where earlier on in this journey, three-year journey of Jesus and the disciples, Simon Peter is designated to be the successor rabbi to Jesus. We miss most of that because we don't understand the context of what's embodied in those words, bind and loose, the authority that Jesus gives Simon. So then Simon's the rabbi in training. You know, for half of the time these guys are on the trail, he's the rabbi in training when Jesus puts him in the servant seat, the last seat, the least important seat at the triclinium table of the Last Supper. Simon is the rabbi in training when he blows it with his three denials. And so Jesus has to almost recertify him in the eyes of the band that he hasn't blown it, that he hasn't forfeited his right to be the successor rabbi. And so he has this trifold reconciliation meal covenant thing going on one morning on the beach, where it's observable by the other 10 who are left at this point. And that's why he emerges so powerful as a leader in the first century church in early Acts.
It is so good to listen to you and to learn just about every sentence you give us. And it's if you think about it, folks, talking to our listeners now, it's the context he's talking about. It's that rabbinical first century Hebrew villager mentality that we're so unacquainted with here. But once we get a glimpse of it, how much of Scripture just falls into place and makes sense and gains incredible power. And Doug, again, as always, we're so grateful. I was expecting us to get into Luke 19 again, because we didn't quite finish that off over the last couple of weeks. It's a parable of Jesus. I don't know that we want to get into it now. Maybe we can pick that up next week. We'll go with your best judgment on that one.
Well, we can, but let me just finish off here with an invitation to your listeners. Mm-hmm. If you're intrigued at all with getting up to speed quickly, rapidly, and comprehensively on the context of Jesus in the Gospels, his context, we're going to be having a three-day conference in the Midwest next summer, June 12, 13, 14, where seven well-regarded people in the area of biblical context, including myself. I'm the one who isn't, but the other six sure are heavy hitters. And for 3 days, the seven of us are going to be teaching aspects of Jesus in his context. It's the first time this has ever been done. It's my read on it. It's going to be the World Series of Biblical Context. And if you at all care about these sort of things and have the time available, I would encourage your listeners to come on over to Western Michigan and immerse yourself in 3 days of Jesus in his context.
Well, Carol and I are planning to be there, and and we're looking forward to it. You're still information coming out about that. Your reflection last week or 2 weeks ago dealt with it. And I should remind people of that. On our website at brokenroadradio.com, there is a link to Preserving Bible Times. It's over to the right-hand side of the homepage. See a little scroll sticking out of the mountains there, Preserving Bible Times. You click on that, it'll take you to preservingbibletimes.org, where, among many other things, you can sign up for Doug's monthly newsletter that he calls Reflections. Comes to you at no charge. It's in your email. You'll look forward to it every month, sometimes a couple times a month. It'll make your day whenever it arrives in your mailbox. Preserving Bible Times. Take a look at that website. It's a beautiful site. It's really vast resources for your small group studies and your church library should have some of those things in them. So there's some thoughts for you, Doug.
And in 18 minutes now, another newsletter is going to go out, and this is going to be part two on Jesus's visitation at a wedding in Cana in John 2. So if you're not on the mailing list, you can either quickly do so or in the next day or two sign up, and we'll forward that copy to you anyway. But it's this particular one is trying to give what I think is the most accurate understanding yet of Jesus's encounter with his mother in the back room in a villa in Cana of a wedding feast that's about to run out of wine. And the interaction between Mary and Jesus, I think, has been misunderstood contextually for a very, very long time. I think your listeners will find it of intrigue and interest.
Well, I think so, too. Talking with Doug Greenwald, Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director of Preserving Bible Times. They're out in Columbia, Maryland, just on the outskirts of Washington, where a lot of things are happening. But maybe the most important thing happening in that whole area is Preserving Bible Times. You got to get to know them. Doug, thanks so much. We'll see you next week, okay?
Thanks, guys.
Take care.
Shalom,
thanks,
Doug. Shalom.
Shalom.